You know, I was thinking I was going to write a book on modern marketing or the modern CMO. And I just was kind of spinning my wheels and couldn't get those words on paper. And it was when I really decided that, you know, the intersection of my career had been startups and big companies, that writing from that position of what I knew, the words kind of flew on the paper, and I had the first draft done in about a month.
Welcome back to Beyond High Street. Today's guest is Dave Knox, who began his career like many Miamians at P&G, before going on to creating, owning, and even selling a business. He created a Midwest-based accelerator for startups, which continues today, and most recently checked one off the bucket list by authoring a book called Predicting the Turn, where he examines the high-stakes game of business between startups and blue chips. It's a must-read for the business community.
Predicting the Turn comes out of poker terminology, actually. So in poker, when you're playing Texas Hold'em, the turn is that fourth card. And usually, if you're still in the game at the fourth, it means you think you have something. You think you have the winning hand. And that analogy came from actually talking with a good friend where we were talking about what's this thing going on with big business. And he's the one that sparked this idea of, well, it's high stakes. That today's world is a lot more competitive and a lot more different than what we've ever seen. And it was that word high stakes that kind of led me to look at poker as kind of this terminology and this analogy.
And why high stakes now versus 5 years ago or 10 years ago? Just the risk of where we live in a social environment where one bad move, an entire business goes down?
You know, it's a little that for sure, but it's also in how competition has changed. You know, I grew up in a world with Procter & Gamble where, you know, P&G versus Unilever, Coca-Cola versus Pepsi, you know, that was fierce competition. But in most cases, you were trying to win 1 or 2 points of market share. You weren't necessarily trying to put the other guy out of business. And I think that's the change that we've seen is this new emergent of new types of competitors. You know, Uber didn't lose an ounce of sleep when they put Yellow Cab out of business. These new breed of competition, they're going straight for your throat because in a lot of cases, they think your business is just irrelevant and you're a dinosaur that deserves to kind of go extinct. And I think that's a major change in what competition looks like.
And do you think then the old companies, the P&G Unilevers, that they have that mentality, they've changed to have that mentality, or is it more the disruptive new companies like an Uber that have that mentality?
The disruptors definitely have it, and I think the bigger companies need to get it. You know, some of them have it. You know, that's, you could argue, one of the reasons Amazon has become what it is. You know, Bezos is pretty famous for his saying of your margin is my opportunity. And that's a cutthroat type of mindset of I'm going to go after it. Or, you know, the infamous story of what he did with diapers.com and Quidsy when he was going to win that at all costs. So I think the Fortune 500 needs to realize this has changed and figure out how they're going to adopt to this new reality.
And so you get the name of the book from a buddy talking about poker, but why write the book? And tell me about what, I imagine you've been running around the country speaking to a lot of people about it.
Yeah, so the inspiration of the book actually goes back to the early 2000s. Early 2000s, I was working at Procter & Gamble. And this was right when blogging had kind of just started taking off. And I ended up deciding I wanted to try my hand at blogging. And, you know, that was the time when people were kind of getting fired for doing blogging. And so when I started doing it, it raised a couple of eyebrows. And while I had to deal with that kind of internal, one of the things that came out of it was I had a few people in the literary world reach out to me and say, hey, you know, you've got a really good voice. And that was the first time I'd always enjoyed writing, but I'd never heard somebody tell me I might have something good at it. And so it was that planted the seed in the back of my mind of, you know, one of my bucket list items is I'd love to write a book one day. And for me, the timing that I made today write was both from a personal standpoint and a professional standpoint. One is I just saw that the time was now to have this conversation between startups and big companies and think about these worlds coming together. And second, I was fortuitous enough that we'd sold our agency to WPP. And it was a moment of time where I actually had a little bit more time to actually sit down and write and take a focus on it. So figured the time was now to get it done.
Yeah. And how much time did it actually take in writing?
You know, the crazy part was the actual writing only took about a month, which people are always surprised when I say that. And it took, you know, many months to get it done. And what ended up happening was I kind of spun my wheels at first. You know, I was thinking I was going to write a book on modern marketing or the modern CMO. And I just was kind of spinning my wheels and couldn't get those words on paper. And it was when I really decided that, you know, the intersection of my career had been startups and big companies, that writing from that position of what I knew, the words kind of flew on the paper. And I had the first draft done in about a month.
And then from that, from 1 month of writing a first draft to the day you actually get a hard copy in your hands, what's that? How long is that process?
You know, that took a couple months. You know, I think I delivered the first draft in about late August. And, you know, the book ended up being published in February. I could have had it out probably as early as Thanksgiving that year, but I didn't really think a business book being published during the holiday seasons would make a ton of sense. So decided to hold it off and had the copies, but didn't publish it until February.
And how many days, how many clicks the first week were you looking at Amazon Analytics or other places to see books being sold?
Oh, I was probably on there five times a day just because for me, it was fascinating. I've always, yeah, it's been a long time since I owned my own brand, if you will, or my own business. And so being able to dive in and see this category performing one way, another category performing, it just kind of went back to my being born as a brand guy that was fun to be able to have a physical product again.
You know, it's funny, when I started this pod, I, in your mind, you say you want the quality of the listener over the quantity because you're doing it for a specific target. But human nature, you cannot not look at the analytics and how long people are on or who's coming on and where they're coming from. And it certainly it helps you think about what to change to increase audience size or really length of time people are listening. I'm sure it's the same with you.
Yep, that's exactly it. And you know, for me, I just was really hoping I'd go from two books sold to maybe three books sold in a day. So that was success.
You spent a lot of time in the book about, you mentioned earlier, teaching readers how to foresee the future of their industry. Are there people, you mentioned Uber before, but are there a few others that you look to that were either clients or just those that you think are role models in the industry, that not Miami students, but also really just young entrepreneurs, founders, people should be paying attention to or learning from?
Yeah. So I look at, you know, when you play it out in this space, it's a question of who's the future is yet to be written. So I think there are really interesting examples of folks that have placed bets, and we'll see if those bets actually pay off or not. And so one of my favorite examples is actually in the sports world, in Under Armour. You know, for all intents and purposes, if you look at Under Armour, things are a little bit tough right now. You know, their stock was something like $38 down to $12 last year. You know, they dropped to number three market share. But when I look at the bets that they've done around fitness tracking, that gets me really intrigued that they're putting a bet on a changing face where they might believe that sports brands are going to be revolving around data and not just around, you know, what school they might have signed or what athlete they might have signed. And you know, it's not showing in their numbers right now, but the fact that they have 220 million people that every week are giving them their fitness data, I really believe that is a bet on the future and what they can do with it. So that's one that just fascinates me. And I hope that 4 or 5 years from now, that play actually, you know, comes out working out for them.
And do you think, or are you spending your time now, just as you're going around and talking to businesses, are you talking more to those big businesses understanding the high stakes, or are you talking to these founders and one or two person shops and call it seed round or series A round that are just trying to figure out how to be disruptive to become big business?
Yeah, I would say it's actually kind of an equal mix between the two. you know, the big business ones, it's obvious of how should they think and evolve and, you know, kind of embrace this space. But for the smaller companies, whether it's, you know, that seed or Series A or, you know, the investors themselves, it's how they should be thinking about the competitive set and the opportunities and the response to the big companies. Because a lot of the big companies, they are awakening to the fact, and the startups need to know how to address that. And it could be an opportunity or it could be a threat for them. So I'm finding myself kind of splitting the time. And even, you know, lately actually spending a lot of time on college campuses, which is kind of fun. You know, I was at one last night, and actually later on today, I'm heading up to Miami University to kind of talk about the book to our future entrepreneurs that will be graduating soon.
And so what are you doing there? Is that a particular class you're talking to? Or when you're going to universities, is it a the startup club, or who are you talking to?
Yeah, so like last night, for instance, was Northern Kentucky University here in town. And for that group, it was, they have a really cool program called the Incubator that is their workshop for student ideas and student entrepreneurship. Tonight, going up to Miami, it's going to be, they have a thematic focus on corporate entrepreneurship. And so I'll be going in, and it's part of their book club for their corporate entrepreneurship track that I'll be going up talk to. I think it's about 100 students.
That's great. I mean, 5 years ago, there was no such thing on campus, or 10 years ago, no such thing. Probably the fastest growing or hottest club to get into at a university.
Exactly. Well, and it's, you know, I think corporate entrepreneurship itself is a really interesting because, you know, most people, when they graduate, they're not going to be founders at the age of 22. They don't have the inspiration necessarily for the new ideas and the things they're going to go tackle. And going in and being able to be a change agent and help bring a different way of thinking in a corporate environment is a really interesting place, I think, for some of these students to end up.
How much do you think Shark Tank has influenced this or helped create this buzz of the new age in founders? Cuban has a great line. Mark says, we're just the new age lemonade stand. And you used to be able to just learn in your front, and now it's front and center with mass media, and it just excites people.
Yeah, you know, I think that this the rise of entrepreneurship, you know, it started with the movie The Social Network. You know, that's what put it into pop culture, that suddenly people got this and they understood it. And Shark Tank has really taken that, you know, driven that wave. And what I love is that, you know, not just the seeing it and the excitement, but the lingo that people start understanding and being able to see, like, what is a valuation? What's it mean if you raise this much money, you give up X percent of your company? You know, that's really fun to see that understanding start pervading across culture.
And where did all this come? Where did you get the interest or desire to head down this path? I mean, you mentioned you left Miami, you did what many people from Miami do and drive down the road and work at P&G for a bit. But then you started running your own agency and got into the venture space and ultimately an accelerator. Where was the shift for you to get into this space?
Yeah, so, you know, the interest in entrepreneurship for me actually started back in high school. So as geeky as it sounds, you know, I was the editor of our high school yearbook. And the reason I even got into that was actually helping doing some advertising sales for them. And, you know, during one summer, sold something like $20,000 of ads and made like $6,000 doing it. And, you know, I was looking at the job I had the summer before being a soccer referee and, you know, the $8 I was making a game. It was like, yeah, this is actually a much cooler way to make a living, to go off and do it. So that's where the entrepreneurship kind of drive started. And what ended up happening was I thought I was going to go into the music industry. So that was the space. I have no musical talent, but I love the industry. And I had a chance to work for a guy named Greg Latterman, who is the founder of Aware Records. And, you know, arguably one of the more important musical figures of our time is, you know, the guy who discovered Hootie and the Blowfish and Train and John Mayer and, you know, the list kind of goes on and on. And I worked for him the summer that he just signed John Mayer, and we were going to launch Mayer that summer and had a blast doing it. And Greg's the one that sat me down and said, look, you know, you can go and come into the music industry, but you're just going to be another guy that's trying to claw his way up the ranks. But you've got an opportunity. You can go get some classical training and come back if you want later on with a very specific skill set that we don't have as an industry. So that's actually what led me going into the Procter & Gamble side of things. And what was fascinating was when I was at Aware, it was when Napster had just launched. They were doing their own e-commerce site at Aware. So I saw kind of this change that digital was bringing in. And that's what kind of led me into P&G doing a lot of the stuff on the digital world was the experience I'd had on the entrepreneurial side.
And would you take that if you started over again and you left Miami again? Would you do the same thing? Do you think that classical training from a big CPG business and shifting from role to role has helped you where you are now?
100%. And it's helped me really from three different verticals, I think. The one is, the network that came about was amazing. When you were talking with Jay Livingston, he talked about, when you go to an MBA, one of the things you get is this network, which is really powerful. And that was something I initially lacked when I started at P&G, because all my peers, they were guys coming from Harvard MBAs and other programs. But the P&G alumni network has been so powerful. And, that's been a lasting effect on me for a long time. So that was one really big thing. The second was, being at a company like this, you could get tremendous kind of responsibility well before you deserve that responsibility. So when I was 26, 27, I got sent down to the Walmart customer team. And, I was managing as the marketer a $900 million piece of business and had about $21 million of marketing spend that I was solely responsible for. Like, I had no right to have that type of budget, but it was because I was in that place I could do it. And, then the third part was really the fact that when you're at a big company like that, you can make mistakes on somebody else's dime. And, no one graduates perfect from college. And frankly, we're still not perfect when we hit 30, 40, et cetera. But being at a place where I could make $100,000, $500,000 mistake, and it wasn't career ending, that was really, really powerful at a young age to be able to do that.
Your comment on Walmart is so true. For those that have not gone down to Fayetteville or Northwest Arkansas Airport in Bentonville, you could just sit in that lobby with a resume, and the CEOs and CMOs, and if you like the celebrity side, the entertainers, musicians, and athletes that go through that airport every single day to sit and meet with the customer teams at Walmart. I mean, every big business has an office down there. The Ruth's Chris, I always laugh, there's a Ruth's Chris in town. You go there for dinner, it's maybe the single best networking restaurant in the entire country.
Oh, no doubt about it. Absolutely no doubt about it. So it's a powerful thing.
You then started an accelerator. Were you at WPP or was that on your own? How did that come about?
Yeah, so the Brandery got started was myself and a guy named JB Kropp were the first two that kind of talked about it, and eventually brought in a few other guys, Rob McDonald and Brian Racky and others. And really the way it got started was I was on the corporate digital team at P&G, and in that role I was getting to do a lot of engagement with the venture capital community and with Silicon Valley and other things. And I was coming back to Cincinnati, and JB was at Share This at the time. And we were talking, and I said, why is it that Cincinnati doesn't have the same entrepreneurial culture that I'm seeing in these other markets? And one of the things JB said was, it's mentorship. We don't have the role models necessarily in town that can inspire the entrepreneurs. And this was right when Techstars was getting going and some others. So we decided that, we wanted to change that and see what we could do in town around that. So that was the inspiration for the Brandery. And it's also why we actually set up that accelerator as a nonprofit, which a lot of people I don't think realize. And every piece of equity that we have is going back to entrepreneurship in the Midwest.
That's great.
So that's what led us start it. And, I ended up, the summer we launched it, I ended up quitting P&G about two months later. So they kind of went hand in hand in a lot of ways.
Were any of those accelerator founders with you, Miami, grads or certainly the network that you've created through P&G, there's got to be a bunch of Miamians that you see in the marketplace every day.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. We had a fun with Miami. While none of the other founders of the program itself were Miami grads, we had a good trend there that every single class, I think for our first 3 years, had at least one Miami grad that was one of the startup founders. So we had a good track record going there.
For the guys that, for the young men and women out there that feel this corporate entrepreneurship, this corporate venture space is for them, and I know you do it socially via Twitter because I'm following you, you're good at sharing all the other smart guys out there. Who are those people? Who are those, I don't know, three or four guys, men, women out there that you look to for inspiration or great thinking on a regular basis?
Yeah, no, if you're looking in the venture capital space, there's three VCs that are kind of the ones that everyone knows and needs to follow because they've done a good job of becoming the social media stars of the space. So that's, Fred Wilson at Union Square in New York. That's Brad Feld, who's at Foundry in Boulder, Colorado. And then Mark Suster, who's at Upfront out in L.A. So those are call them the social media superstars of the space. What I like is that kind of the next layer below that. The guys that, when they share stuff really, really interesting. So one of my favorites is a guy named Benedict Evans, who's at Andreessen Horowitz. And he also publishes a really great newsletter every single week that you can subscribe to. So his stuff is, I think, really fascinating. And then John Borthwick, who's at BetaWorks and is the founder of BetaWorks. His thinking is just, really kind of eye-opening in a lot of different ways. So those are two that I think are a little bit, maybe not the names that you know first would see, but I think are some of the more interesting ones.
Is there a book number two in the horizon? Have you already started to game plan that?
That's the great debate is, do I want to go through that again? And I think there's probably a good chance I'm going to do it. I might have registered a URL last night for an idea I'm kicking around, so we'll see.
What are we looking for? The predicting the turn gave us a good mindset into how we should foresee the future of the industry. What else? What are you looking for every day, or what are we thinking about 2-3 years down the road that brands or people are not yet registering every day?
Yeah, I think the biggest change that we're going to see is going to be how companies have to respond, but now it's going to be how about people? Because if we look around, even today we've been a culture where if you wanted to go have a career for 30 years at Procter & Gamble, you could still probably do it. I think today we're starting to move into much more of a free agent society that's going to have some really interesting cascading effects. And it's going to be effects on both companies and how we as people think about careers, because career is not necessarily going to be defined by the jobs or the titles that you have.
Every time I hear Dave speak, I learn, especially about analyzing the future of an industry and using that data to set you up for success. Make sure to follow his Twitter handle and the other experts he recommends in the pod. It's Daily Free Learning. Really appreciate you listening and sharing the pod with your friends. See you at Skippers.